So it was a very a pan-European study looking at kind of factors within the way that probation services are organised that either promote or detract from the ability of probation officers to develop resilience in their jobs. And it certainly wasn't a surprise to me that the main finding was that it's organisational climate that has the biggest impact on the reported ability of probation officers to remain resilient in their jobs. There's a great quote from one of the articles that it's nothing at all to do with the offenders. they're kind of, most of the probation officers in the study went, oh no, the bright spot of my day is when I'm actually sitting down face to face with someone who's committed an offence, talking to them about their lives. That's the thing that gets me through.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So today's guest, Lydia Guthrie, trained as both a probation officer and a systemic psychotherapist. She currently works part-time within a CAMS team as a systemic psychotherapist and also offers training, consultancy and supervision across social care, criminal justice, mental health, education and voluntary sectors. Her areas of specialism include attachment theory and attachment-based practice, trauma-informed practice, supervision, motivational interviewing, domestic abuse and sexual offending, and working with resistance as well as resilience and wellbeing. Lydia has worked in services for children, older adults, the probation service, the Latvian probation service and the prison service, and she's co-authored two books as well as a number of other book chapters. Lydia, we're really delighted to welcome you along today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation, Naomi and David. It's really lovely to be speaking with you.
Hi Lydia, very nice to meet you, and I hope at some stage of the conversation something is going to come up about the Latvian probation service, which sounds intriguing, and maybe it'll be here because yeah. Lydia, you've had a long and varied career working in different specialities and drawing on knowledge and skills from very diverse sources. Can you talk us through your career pathway?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. When I heard Naomi reading that out, it occurred to me that some people might think I sound like I just can't make my mind up. there are a few moments that feel really salient in terms of thinking about my career and decisions that I've made at different points. I remember as an undergraduate, I volunteered for a charity working with young people on the edge of care, young people who were in contact with social services, and doing residential based programs with them. And as part of that work, I used to spend a day a week with a children's services social worker, going round houses in the housing estates that surround Oxford, which is where I was studying. I used to go in and out of houses with families in Blackbird Leys and Rose Hill. And one day I have a very, very vivid memory of getting off the bus, the number 52 bus that took you to Blackbird Leys, getting off that bus in the middle of High Street, right in the centre of the University at Oxford, and seeing around me the affluence, the wealth, and the lack of curiosity about what was going on a mile and a half up the road for families who were living in poverty in Oxford. It's a city of great inequality. Huge wealth and huge disadvantage, living literally side by side. And I remember at that moment just being stopped in my tracks, being frozen at seeing a group of students, very much like that photo that we all know of the Bullingdon Club, of the very affluent young men in dinner jackets standing on steps. And seeing a group of young men in that mode, having just come from sitting with families in Blackbird Leys, and feeling at that moment that was something wrong. It was just a somatic experience of this is not okay, that the world is this way. And I don't know what I'm going to do about it, but this is the area that I want to work in. And I think that has really stayed with me, that consciousness of social injustice, social inequality, oppression, the way that that social systems are constructed to promote some people and to disadvantage others. So that's been that's kind of quite a long way of saying that's been a golden thread, I think, that's run through all of my career. And it was what set me on the path of training as a social worker in the first place. I then went into the probation service, having qualified as a social worker, with, I think that was motivated by what I now think was rather a naive idea. I did a placement in child protection, and I felt that children's services tended to focus on people who were struggling because of their poverty. And it felt, I was uncomfortable with the what felt like randomness of it, where the social care came knocking on your door, to me, seemed to be a lot to do with money and social class, and a lot less to do with your children. And to me that felt wrong. It felt oppressive, I guess. And I had this idea that the probation service was somehow more pure because we only got involved with people if they'd broken the law. So that was some kind of, you know, morally neutral determinant of who we worked with and who we didn't. Looking back now, that was, as I say, a very naive idea, the idea that the criminal justice, you know, this idea of justice being blind, utterly accept isn't true. And all the research about who is subject to criminal justice interventions, we all know that black men, for example, are far more likely to be committed of serious crime than white men, for example. So it was an idea that really spurred me on at the time, was I can practice with a clear conscience in this world of criminal justice because people have broken the law or they haven't. And that's a good reason for me to, that I have a mandate for being involved in their lives, I guess. As a probation officer, I started off as a group worker. So my very first day as a probation officer, I was a group worker in the Welsh Valleys with Jane and Nigel, who taught me a huge amount. I was a white Oxford graduate running drink drive groups in a probation day centre in Newport. I very quickly realised it was going to be sink or swim. And I learnt a huge amount very quickly and loved it. And I think group work has been another golden thread that's gone through my career, whether the group is a probation group, looking at a particular form of violent or sexual behaviour, for example, or whether it's been a family. Families are the first groups most of us belong to, and now as a family therapist I spend most of my time working with groups. I think another golden thread would be attachment theory. So I first began to get interested in attachment theory when I was running the community sex offender group work programs, where we had a very narrative approach. We would ask men, tell us a bit about your life growing up and what you learnt from different experiences and relationships. I quickly learnt to associate that with attachment theory. And in particular with the Patricia Crittenden's dynamic maturational model of attachment and adaptation. And then I think also supervision has been a real thread for me, both seeking good supervision. I've been lucky to have some fabulous supervisors throughout my life. I currently, for the last 6 years or so, I've had private supervision with Professor Arlene Vetterer, who is a giant of the family therapy field, and I've been hugely fortunate to learn a massive amount from her. And I've also been a supervisor for a long time, both in the probation service and privately. So that's through that work, I have a real commitment to supporting and sustaining practitioners as human beings in these complex systems that we find ourselves in. So I guess it's unusual in a way in that I've worked pretty much equally in criminal justice, social care, and forensic systems, and now in the NHS in children's and adolescent mental health. But for me, there are some. It makes sense in my mind. Arlene calls me liminal. She says I'm a liminal practitioner. I work at the boundary points. You know where. and because I tend to put myself down and say that, you know, maybe I should have just decided what to do and stuck to it. Whereas Arlene helps me to take a much more compassionate approach to myself and to embrace the diversity and the richness of learning from those liminal lands where different settings and approaches meet each other.
I was just wondering then whether it would be helpful to just to say something briefly about what good supervision entails, because I'm conscious of not everybody who listens to the podcast is a psychologist or a psychotherapist, and so I think supervision just conjure up other connotations for disciplines that aren't steeped in a history of supervision.
Yeah, that's a great point, Naomi. The term supervision, I guess to some of the people listening, they might associate that with having a probation officer, being under probation supervision, which I imagine is a very different experience. Although should it be? I guess that's an interesting question. Maybe they should be more aligned. But for me, my understanding of supervision would be as a systemic psychotherapist, it's a requirement of my job. In order to remain professionally registered, I have to have a certain amount of professional supervision a month. And I have to record that as part of my continuous professional development. So it's a key professional responsibility. And for me, supervision involves having private conversations that are bound by principles of confidentiality with a supervisor, some of whom I choose and some of whom are allocated to me, about my experiences of my work. So any dilemmas or conflicts that I'm facing, places that I feel stuck. Sometimes a place to share successes and to hang on to moments where I feel I've achieved something, and also to talk about myself as a person. And I have several supervisors at the moment, and the amount, the balance between those conversations can be different with different supervisors. But certainly in my private clinical supervision, at times it can feel like therapy. It isn't. I'm lucky my private supervisor is a very skilled therapist, so perhaps the lines are a bit blurry there. But I can talk to my private clinical supervisor, Arlene, about very personal aspects of self, places where my professional work and my personal experiences collide, and the strong feelings and thoughts that might arise from that. So it's this idea of taking care of myself so that I can take care of others. I guess that's a very simple way of putting it.
I was also going to suggest that I think what it shares in common with therapy, I think, is good supervision should also enable growth. And I think sometimes when we're looking for supervisors, we can prioritise people who we like and we feel safe being, you know, discussing some of our own vulnerabilities with, but actually some of the best supervisors might be people who ask questions that challenge us and make us think about things a bit differently. And I suppose it also brings up the theme of sometimes it's good to have a supervisor that's totally separate to where you work, but sometimes it's useful to have a supervisor who works in the same service, because I suppose we bring to supervision what we're conscious of as a potential barrier, whereas a supervisor who sees us on a day-to-day basis might be aware that there are things that we perhaps ought to be talking about but we might be avoiding.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Naomi. And I'm lucky to have two great supervisors, one in my work setting in the NHS and one outside. And the conversations are very different. The senior family therapist who supervises my family therapy work sees me in family therapy clinic. And so she can take moments of practice which she's observed and say, let's just go back to this moment here. What were you aware of? What were you noticing? What motivated that question? What did you think about the family's response? Why didn't you ask this? and she can talk to me about the organisational context because she's in it too. And that definitely has benefits. It's a huge luxury to also have a supervisor outside my agency context. It's a different experience because she doesn't see me work. All of the things I bring to her are things I choose to bring to her, and I describe them in the way I choose to describe them. So you're absolutely right there, Naomi. What am I choosing to omit? what am I not talking about? And she wouldn't have access to those experiences. So that's a really good point. I think I'm lucky enough to know my outside supervisor well enough that she can be quite challenging with me. But what underpins that is the relationship that we have of respect and trust and compassion. So that I think that enables her to ask me really difficult questions and to make to make links which challenge me. She will ask me very challenging questions. You know, what's the link between you doing this work and that particular experience in your own life? Or how do you cope with this as a mother of teenagers? Or she very sweetly told me off in the last supervision. I told her about how challenged I felt working with a particular teenager who'd had some very traumatic experiences, and I shared with her a question that I'd asked her, and she said she asked my permission to give me her reaction, and I said yes, please. And then she said, "What you just described was a technique. It wasn't connection. It was a technique. And don't do that." And she very gently, she said words that really affected my practice the next time I worked with this girl. She said to me, "Your skill is you're very empathic, you're able to connect with people's emotional experience and to help them to notice it and name it in simple terms. Drop these fancy techniques and just do that. Just be real." And she was absolutely right. She really was. I was so overwhelmed by what this girl had experienced that I resorted to a technique. So thanks, Arlene, for that one. You were absolutely right. and I think that's growth. For me, that's growth. Noticing my own abhorrence at the nature of this child's experiences, and noticing that in that moment I chose to use a technique as a shield for myself. And that didn't serve either of us very well.
But you're also highlighting something else that's common, I think, between therapy and supervision, in the sense of she was able to be challenging because you had faith and trust in her speaking with your best interests at heart. And I think that's also mirrored in therapy, that actually we can give really tough, challenging feedback to people if they appreciate that we actually have care for them, and the feedback is coming from a place of it has integrity and wants to be useful. It's not about being malicious or trying to destroy or attack the person.
Yeah, very much so. For me, it was also important that she sought permission. She named what she was about to do. She said, "I have a thought about this which might be challenging for you to hear, but I'm wondering if it's okay to share it." And so for me, there was something very powerful about naming the processes that were happening between us, and seeking my consent. It felt respectful. It felt offered with love, actually, and with my best interests at heart, very much so.
So there were essential elements there of containment and trust, it seems to me.
Very much so.
So anyway, thanks very much for that. It's a terrific discussion about supervision and the meaning of how we understand supervision, really. One of the books you've written is called Changing Offending Behaviour. And what's really striking about this book is that you reference 20 psychological theories or models that you and Clark Baim drew upon in devising the exercises to support people in changing their behaviour. You also encourage readers to make use of any further theories they may be familiar with. And these days, this seems at odds with the trend towards specialising in one model. Indeed, much of the requirements for personality disorder programmes, for example, stresses having a clear, unified, implied, singular model. So can you say something about how you and Clark came to write the book and why you adopted this particular approach?
Another great question there, David. First of all, I think it's just really important to acknowledge how important my working relationship with Clark Baim has been. I've been deeply fortunate to work very closely with Clark since the early 2000s, first of all in the context of the Community Sex Offender Group Work programmes, and his work with Geese Theatre, which he set up and was the founder member of in the UK, and then later running Change Point Limited, a training company together, and co-writing lots of different materials and books and programmes together. So it's been a hugely rich professional relationship. And one of the reasons that Clark and I draw so widely on different psychological theories and models is, reflects our own trainings. We both have multiple trainings, so it would be deeply inconsistent for us both to hold up one approach and say, hey folks, we've found the answer, this is it. So there's something there about it mirroring our personal stories. I think also, I don't know about you, but working in forensic settings with people whose behaviour is really difficult to make sense of, really difficult to understand for them and for us as professionals. I like to use any theory that helps, really. I'm certainly not aware of any theory that I would say has cracked the whole thing. You know, it would be a deeply arrogant approach of any theory to say, hey folks, this one's the answer. All those other theories, you can chuck them away now. it's also the idea that theories aren't influenced by each other is a peculiar idea to me. If I'm going to read something that someone's written, I want to know what their influences are. I want to understand more about their context, about their training. So that, you know, theories develop in the context of all the other theories we've already got. So, you know, that's how we work. So Clark and I came to write this book. I don't know if Clark would agree with this. I think he probably would. It was written as an act of defiance. Defiant generosity, I think. That at the time Clark and I were writing programmes and doing lots of training for agencies who were copywriting and licensing programmes and approaches, which are not acknowledging the shoulders of giants upon whom they stood. The drive towards the accreditation of programs, the idea that some approaches were to be canonized and held up as the only effective ways of working with people and others were to be thrown aside. That was something I always struggled with, which isn't the same as saying I don't believe that things need an evidence base. Of course they do. Evidence-based approaches, evidence-informed practice is a hallmark of professionalism. And we all have to be curious about evidence. But there's a difference between that and professional arrogance, I think. So Clark and I thought that we'd learn a huge amount from working with thousands of trainee probation officers, prison officers, psychologists, psychotherapists, psychiatrists, social workers. What we experienced working with practitioners was an enormous professional generosity, a desire to support and encourage each other, and that wasn't mirrored by the organisations within which we found ourselves working. So what we thought we would do is try to write a book of exercises ideas, approaches, starting points to support practitioners in their work face to face with whoever it was they were working with, whatever context they were in. So it was, and we thought we wanted it to be available at a reasonable price and photocopyable. My years as a probation officer, spending times frantically preparing for sessions and running around the office looking for resources, made me absolutely committed to it being photocopyable and to waiving our copyright. So we had some, Steve Jones from Jessica Kingsley Publishing really understood our aims and was very happy to go ahead with that. And his support was great. So we produced a reasonably priced A4 book, as you say, referencing 20 different theories, giving quick summaries of them, giving references for further reading so that people could expand their own repertoire. There's also a chapter on how we work with people. So skills, approaches, ways of thinking about people, ways of building relationships, ways of coping with resistance or understanding denial, for example. And then a group of exercises, which are very far from a manual. It's the opposite of a manual, really. It's much more of a guide, much more of a kind of a set of resources, I suppose, that the individual practitioner can draw upon in their relationship-based work. An act of defiant generosity, I would say, drawing upon everything that we'd learned in our own trainings and from all the people who came on courses who we were inspired by.
That's a great way of describing things. I was discussing this with Naomi before we began. I'm also very suspicious of copyrighted and licensed programs. I regard them as a product of a particular political ideology, really. And I, like you, agree with the idea of shared knowledge. And we managed very well with that for quite a number of centuries. Anyway, one of the theories you draw upon in the book is attachment theory. And for the benefit of listeners who aren't familiar with this, I wonder if you could briefly outline what you mean by this.
Yeah, so Patricia Crittenden's dynamic maturational model of attachment and adaptation is the model of attachment which I've studied in the greatest depth. I did an MSc in that model of attachment at Roehampton University, which was a wonderful course that I really recommend, which really added to my practice and understanding. And her real focus in the way that she writes about attachment is she focuses on danger and survival. Her critique of other models of attachment is that they put the focus on safety and comfort. So this kind of simple model of how infants achieve safety and comfort from their attachment figure, their primary carer. And of course, working in a forensic settings, many of us will have worked with individuals who have never known safety and comfort. So what do you do if it's simply not an option? What do you do if the person who's caring for you, because of their own life situation, because of their own life history or narrative, isn't in a position to offer safety and comfort? And some models of attachment theory can't really account for that. Or they account for it in a very simple way by saying that you would go on to develop disorganized attachment, which is just a real mess and we don't really know what it means, but it's bad. Whereas Dr. Patricia Crittenden's model is very much focused on this idea that we need to focus on danger as opposed to safety. So how through their early experiences does an individual learn to navigate the dangers which are present in their world, their relational world, their wider context, their cultural and social context? How do they learn to navigate that and make sense of it? And how can their caregiver support them to do that? So one of her ideas that has really transformed my practice is to work with people by first of all considering a chronology of dangers. What dangers has this person faced? How did they learn to adapt to those dangers? And how are those lessons helping or hindering them in the here and now? In a forensic setting, how did those early lessons contribute to the series of decisions they made that led to them committing the offence or offences? And so focusing on survival in the face of danger. And danger in this sense would be anything that threatens survival, anything that threatens our ability to protect our own families as we grow and develop. And so she writes very powerfully about how infants might learn to take shortcuts in the way that they understand the world around them. So faced with a caregiver who is perhaps in a consistent way not tuned in to the infant's signals of distress, then an infant might learn not to signal distress. If your cries only make things worse for you, you pretty soon learn not to cry. And as an infant, that could be really adaptive. That could help you survive. It could reduce threat from a threatening caregiver. But as an adult, not tuning into your own internal signals of distress or your own emotions can lead to huge problems and can, as we all know, can contribute to people's offending behaviour. So that's been a model that for me has been really transformative in terms of my own practice and the way that I understand my own life story.
And that's particularly relevant, isn't it, in terms of thinking about ourselves as people who represent organisations and the way that people relate to the organisation. So I think quite often, as a psychologist or a psychotherapist, the assumption is there that you're offering something good to the person because that's your intention, and so you expect to be treated as somebody who's safe. But of course, if you have no experiences of safety, this person who's trying to get close to you represents an imminent threat.
Yeah, absolutely. That if your experiences are that when people sit with you and say, hey, you can trust me, look at me, I've got nice kind eyes and a big smile, and I'm doing that therapist nodding thing when you speak and saying, yes, yes, you can tell me anything. If your experiences of that have been that it's led to danger, either internal danger in terms of confronting or provoking difficult emotions, which you find very hard to contain, or an external danger, maybe it's been written about in reports that have then been shared really widely. You know, maybe you feel it's led to you being denied parole or information being shared with your family that you never wanted them to know about, for example. Then sure, we might think we're offering safety and comfort and predictability and attunement and warmth, but you know, what really matters isn't what we think we're offering, it's how the person sitting the other side of the table from us experiences it. And very often, we're not very good at talking about that. One of the things I've learned the most about through systemic theory, so family therapy training, is bringing the relationship in the here and now also into the room. You know, when I ask you, how are you? What do you hear? You know, how are these questions feeling for you? I noticed when I asked you about your experiences growing up, you that seemed like a hard question to answer. You know, what's difficult about that? Which of my questions have been the most difficult? Which have been the most comfortable to answer? You know, what's your fear about what I might do with these answers? What does it mean for you? You know, so answering simple human questions about what's going on in the here and now between us. And too often, certainly in my initial training in the probation service, we were told to kind of leave our personal selves at the door. You know, we're here to do this CBT informed work. The relationship with us as the worker is pretty much off limits. You know, it's less relevant. And I think that's not an approach that I found very effective, personally speaking.
Yeah, I think sadly that's still quite common, isn't it, that people are encouraged not to share anything of themselves personally out of a fear of what the person might do with it, rather than recognising there's a human need to connect.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. I mean, in conversations about forensic matters, I often find that there's this real binary thinking going on. You're either for the victim or you're for the offender. You know, you're either doing risk assessment or you're doing therapeutic stuff. And I guess it feels important to name out loud that I think sometimes it's more subtle positions that are the most useful. Of course, sometimes we go to one end of that binary or another, but we need to be able to do both of them all the time, I think. And that for me is where the complexity comes in forensic work. You know, what if I'm choosing whether or not to reveal something to somebody about myself, I want to know what their intentions are. And why should it be any different for anyone who's committed an offence? I think there are ways of responding to those kinds of personal inquiries which respect the intention of the inquiry whilst keeping purely personal information private. If that makes sense. Talking around it, you know, why is it you're asking me that? You know, what difference will my answer make to you? What is it you really want to know? Because there's some stuff that I can't share that wouldn't be appropriate to share. But what is it that I can share that would help you feel more comfortable, or help answer that genuine, authentic inquiry you might have about me as a human being? And I have the same dilemma sometimes in CAMHS. So I work in a child and adolescent mental health setting now in the NHS, and I have two children who are 15 and 17. And many of the young people I work with are very, very similar ages. So I very often find myself thinking, you know, I'm listening to a mother who's at her wit's end trying to negotiate with a teenager. Would it help this mum for me to know, I get this. This happens in my house too. Who am I saying that for? Am I saying it for my own benefit as a shortcut to building rapport with this person, which is wrong? Or am I saying it because actually I think there's a therapeutic benefit or something that would be useful to this person in the here and now?
Yeah. I think we're over to you, Naomi.
You look like you were laughing, David. So, one of your pieces of writing that really piqued our interest, Lydia, given the theme of our podcast, has been your chapter Building and Sustaining a Resilient Workforce, which appeared in Contemporary Sex Offender Risk Management. A few of our guests have spoken about resilience. Can you tell us how you conceptualise it?
Yeah, again, another great question. Resilience is one of those terms that gets talked about a lot. So it, like attachment theory, it's overused but underdefined, I think. And very often people will have conversations about resilience thinking they're talking about the same thing, but they've actually got very different concepts in mind. So I think it's really important to be very clear what we're talking about. And the literature tends to talk about resilience as, you know, a desirable outcome. If someone can work as a probation officer at the coalface for 20 years and not develop any kind of terrible illnesses or have long periods of time on sick leave, then that's resilient. You know, so it's seen as a good outcome. It's also sometimes talked of as a personality trait. You know, why are you struggling while those other people in your team over there aren't struggling? They must just be more resilient than you are. I think we can also think about it as a process. How do individuals adapt to circumstances they find themselves in and develop skills and strategies and ways of coping with adversity? We can use it when we're thinking about professionals. We can also use the term when we're thinking about young people. It's used a lot in children's mental health. You know, how do we encourage resilience in young people? There's often you go to trainings where there's a slide of a piece of concrete with a crack in it and a weed growing through or a little plant growing through, and it's like how do we nurture growth out of adversity. So we can mean a number of things by it, and it's really important to be clear, or else people are talking at cross purposes, I think. It's also one of, I guess I have some moral or ethical concerns as well. Whenever I'm approached by an organisation to do training on resilience, I have a bunch of ethical concerns about, are you interested in talking about organisational culture and wider organisational systems, or do you just want staff to have some checklists of do's and don'ts and to work at a purely personal and individual level for coping with stress? Are we going to be allowed to talk about workload or not is often a question I ask organisations to figure out what their ethical position is on resilience. Because it can be used as a term effectively to beat people up, you know, that you're struggling because you're not resilient enough, rather than you're struggling because you've got a massive workload, the IT system's rubbish, and you don't have enough support.
Absolutely. Especially as you were talking, it just reminded me of, I recently watched Gabor Maté's film The Wisdom of Trauma, where he talks about it's not so much the traumatic incident that's the problem, it's the response to the traumatic incident from those around. And I think that, you know, too often when we talk about resilience, we're talking about the individual's responsibility rather than thinking, if you're in a job, for instance, that involves exposure to a lot of adversity or really challenging things to hear about, that something about how the organisation makes it possible for the staff and the people that perhaps live or use that, that organisation to be able to stay healthy or that promote healthiness in those individuals.
Yeah, very much so. Toni Morrison, who's been another huge influence on my career, he wrote a sentence that always stays with me, that if we want people to work at the interface of pain, poverty and powerlessness, and to help them stay close enough to the action, then we need to support them. And I found that a really powerful phrase. I might have slightly misquoted, apologies if I have, but that's very much the gist of it. The idea that if you are faced with people's pain and the consequences of trauma in your work, then one response is to cut off from it. I think that's what he means by staying close enough to the action, is showing up for people and being able to hear, being able to contain, being able to bear witness to what people have suffered and the suffering they may have inflicted on others. One response would be to cut off from that and to just go through the motions and practice on a purely cognitive level, which I think can be harmful. And another response is to take that all on yourself. If you're not supported enough, then that can be harmful for the individual practitioner. So for me, resilience is that balance of being able to show up, being able to attend to feelings, emotions, pain, as well as all the cognitive stuff we have to do, the risk assessments, the reports, you know, all that stuff's equally important. But how do we support people to sustain that and to keep growing, to keep learning? And for me, that's the real heart of resilience.
That's beautifully put. Thank you. And you describe three models of resilience in the workplace. Could you talk us through these and, you know, what are the similarities and differences between them?
Sure. I actually found this a really difficult book chapter to write. This book chapter on resilience, and I read loads of stuff. I had a huge moment of personal crisis of, who am I to be writing about this stuff? So many better people than me have written about it in the past, and why am I doing it? And my husband pointed out that it would be hugely ironic if it was writing a book chapter on resilience that finally pushed me over the edge. that really helped me actually to get a bit of distance from it, and to try to pull together all these strands from brilliant authors to hopefully write something useful. The approaches that spoke to me the most, really, so Professor Jo Clark's model of dynamic adaptation, she derived this model from her PhD research based on work in a prison. And one of the things I love about her model is that she identifies four kind of pillars of resilience. And at each of these areas, she promotes a possible type of intervention to support resilience. So I love that because it's very practical. I love a good theory, but a good theory on its own never helped anyone. It's about how we put that theory into practice. And I guess that's been a strand that's run through all my work, really, is trying to understand theories and then to support practitioners to put them in on their feet. And I think Jo Clark does that brilliantly with her model of dynamic adaptation. And she talks about characteristics of the individual worker, dynamic factors. So those bolts from the blue that can come in and affect us that we can't predict, and they can be in our personal lives or in our professional experience. She writes about aspects of the job role, so how the job is organised, your team, your supervision arrangements, all of that would come into job role. And then she talks about the kinds of outcomes that we're aiming for. And what I really value about her work is that she looks at places we can intervene to promote resilient outcomes at each level of a practitioner's work with their organisation, from selection right the way through to something bad happening. And it's this old idea of most organisations, organisations. I remember hearing her speak at a conference and she said most organisations have really good policies for supporting someone after a traumatic event has happened. Most organisations have investment in counselling or traumatic debriefing services, that kind of thing. And that's great, so they should. But she says, wouldn't it be brilliant to put the fence at the top of the cliff rather than the ambulance at the bottom? Which I think is a great way of thinking about it. Let's look at how to promote resilience right the way from training and selection to how job roles are organised, to how we support people balance their work lives and their personal lives. So that's one of the things I love about her model. A model that she's very influenced by is Peyton's model of the stress shield model. She says this is the one with the greatest evidence base. And this model talks about the organisation, the team and the individual and the kind of connections between them and how they work together or otherwise to promote resilience. And Peyton writes really powerfully about empowerment. He's found a link between this concept of empowerment and outcomes for professionals, which kind of boils down to ideas of how meaningful do people find their work? Do people feel that they can make an influence on the way that their work is organised? Do they feel listened to? Do they feel that they've got some aspects of choice? And can they see positive impact of their work, even in difficult situations? So that's a really lovely model. And I was also influenced by writings from the social work literature. So Grant and Kinman and Adamson and Liz Beddow, they've all written very powerfully about resilience in a social work context. One of the things that I find really powerful about their work is they talk about the connections between individual practitioners or workers, their work environment, their practice context, and the connection between the two. So they write about the space between the individual and their practice context. And they write really powerfully about the importance of a developing professional identity, developing professional networks, continuous professional development, and growing and enhancing a knowledge base. So those are all factors. I mean, I guess they would matter to me, having spent 10 years in training and supervision. I'd kind of have to say I think those things are important. But I genuinely do. There is good evidence base that practitioners who are constantly expanding their knowledge base, who are engaging in meaningful CPD rather than, you know, going on mandatory courses on manual handling and stuff, but meaningful professional and personal development tend to have better resilient outcomes over the length of their career. So I think in writing the chapter, I drew on all three of these models because I think they all have something really powerful and useful to offer to our conversations about resilience.
Yeah, and you can really hear I think in that last model that you were describing, you could really hear the advantages of, I suppose, encouraging people to foster curiosity and continued growth, you know, that actually that might mean that you encounter things that are difficult, but then how do you make meaning out of it and what do you have to learn going forward rather than spend time regretting or feeling bad about what's happened.
Yeah, absolutely. The ideas that how do we acknowledge difficult or traumatic experiences that we might experience at work? How do we make sense of them and how do we make meaning from them? And how do we take that learning into the future? There's a huge link here with attachment theory. How do we learn from danger? How do we respond to danger? How do we reflect on those responses? I think it's Dan Siegel who said that the only information we have is information about the past, but the information that we really need is information about the future. Which I guess goes to the heart of forensic risk assessment, doesn't it? I suppose that all we have is the past. But I think it's really relevant here as well. How as professionals do we make sense of our difficult and challenging experiences and make meaning out of them?
Thank you. One of the challenges you highlighted within your chapter was that of courtesy stigma. Can you describe what you mean by this?
Yeah, I was really delighted to come across this phrase because it made such sense to me. It's a phrase, I think it comes from Lee et al. And it's the idea that of a negative stigma which attaches to professionals who work with particular groups in society. I think they use the phrase of dirty work in inverted commas. The idea that there's somehow a contagion effect from being associated with stigmatized or excluded groups within society. And I guess for me, I spent 10 years working exclusively with people who had convictions for sexual offences. So it was certainly something that I experienced in that role. The idea that if you can work with those people, what does that say about you? Does that mean that you somehow think it's okay to sexually offend? You know, how do you sleep at night working with people who've done things like that? And this idea that as a society we're very often appalled by the behaviour, which is entirely appropriate, but in doing so we can also be appalled by the person, and we can reject the person as well as the behaviour.
I think that really cropped up during the early part of the pandemic, actually, where prison officers who were in face-to-face contact with people, you know, and were needed to keep going to work and keep running, and there were lots of people were giving free coffees to NHS staff and so people working in social care, because there was a recognition that that work was valuable. But actually there was something, I think for prison officers it's often felt as if they are contaminated by a population that there's little positive regard for from society. But I also recognise that experience from working with a population that have been labelled personality disorders, which again, you know, rather than us seeing that these are traumatised, hurt people, which engages our vulnerability, too often that, you know, they're viewed with contempt or even hatred, perhaps by some professionals, some groups of society.
Very much so. I once read an article which analysed tabloid headlines and tabloid stories to find the most stigmatised groups in UK tabloid press. And it won't surprise you to hear it was refugees and migrants and people who'd committed sexual offences. And I currently have two charitable roles. I'm a trustee of Circles South East, who run circles of support with released sex offenders in the community. And I also work for a group called the Refugee Resilience Collective, working with refugees and migrants who find themselves stranded in Calais, in what used to be known as the jungle. I guess I experience a lot of courtesy stigma from working with both of those marginalised and vilified groups. I also experience it from my dad. I'm not particularly close to my dad. We're very different people. But he, in one of my last conversations with him, he exclaimed, "So it wasn't enough for you to work with sex offenders. Now you've got to work with refugees too. You couldn't make it up," was his most memorable phrase. So I guess it's important to acknowledge that some of us also will face those questions in our personal networks as well as our professional ones. You know, why do you do that? You know, my I'm not sure my dad's ever really understood my career choice. I did politics, philosophy and economics at Oxford. He had great hopes for me becoming a stockbroker or a banker or I don't know, something else anyway. And he never really understood why I became a probation officer, especially not one who worked with sex offenders out of choice. But I am noticing now in the now that I work for the NHS, I am noticing I get big smiles in places and a lot of discounts. I get a lot of 15% off coffee, which I never got as a so it was a very a pan-European study looking at kind of factors within the way that probation services are organised that either promote or detract from the ability of probation officers to develop resilience in their jobs. And it certainly wasn't a surprise to me that the main finding was that it's organisational climate that has the biggest impact on the reported ability of probation officers to remain resilient in their jobs. There's a great quote from one of the articles that it's nothing at all to do with the offenders. they're kind of, most of the probation officers in the study went, oh no, the bright spot of my day is when I'm actually sitting down face to face with someone who's committed an offence, talking to them about their lives. And nearly 600 probation officers across different European countries, I'm sure I won't remember them all, but the UK, Belgium, the Netherlands, Latvia, Estonia, Bulgaria, I believe. That's the thing that gets me through. That's the thing that helps me put up with all the organisational nonsense. And that certainly mirrored my own experience as a probation officer. That it was those moments of human connection, those moments of feeling that I'm doing something here which is making a difference to somebody, that I had to hang on to as little kind of golden moments to keep me going through the endless bureaucratic nonsense.
So it doesn't sound like you were surprised that it wasn't the people that the probation officers worked with that were the main challenge.
Not at all. That very much confirmed my own experience. And the study found that it was things like management practices, staff members not feeling empowered, not feeling able to influence their context, feeling done to rather than done with, if that makes sense. Issues around workload and issues of communication within organisations, and things like the physical environment as well came out really highly on this list. Can you choose where you sit? Can you make it warmer or colder in your room, in your office? Can you have ventilation? Do you have good toilet and kitchen facilities? You know, these things that should be really basic. But actually in criminal justice settings like probation, like some prisons, are actually really lacking for staff teams.
That's so true. The toilet on the FENS unit is a converted cell which still has the glass panel within it, and it just has a screen up, so there's a sense of you could be quite exposed. No curse, a staff member made a curtain to grow across, because otherwise prisoners from wing facing would be potentially be able to look in, and such little consideration given to decency for staff as well as the people who live in prisons.
Yeah, in the most private and vulnerable moments.
Yeah, I certainly recognise that the conditions for staff in many prisons is diabolical, and of course the contrast, you were talking about the NHS earlier, the contrast with in many, particularly new NHS facilities, is just extraordinary.
Yeah. I, the IT, I've also, I mean, I, before I joined the NHS, I heard lots of bad things about NHS IT systems, but they're so much better than anything I encountered in the criminal justice system. They're kind of designed to do the job that they need to do, rather than being messed about with and retrofitted and bodged to try to make them work.
So the next thing we were interested in was something about the factors that contribute to ecological resilience.
Yeah. Are you thinking about kind of resilience in wider systems there, David?
Well, I guess that's the sort of background of the question, yeah.
Yeah, I guess we've touched on it a little bit in terms of the spore study, or when the Latvian pronunciation is spore, which I think is much better than spore. Cheers. So that's always how I say it in my head. And they touched on the importance of communication. So the importance of people at different positions in the organisation sitting down with each other and asking, how is it in your neck of the woods? You know, what's it like for you in your job? And how can I in my job make that different for you, or make that better for you? Ideas about being able to influence. So ideas that I I, through what I've learned in my role, I can have a conversation with people who have the power to make a difference, to make some changes. And also ideas about kind of valuing learning, valuing continued growth, investment in individuals and their investment in staff as a resource, I guess. And the idea that continuous professional development is something that we do with staff rather than at them. So what are you interested in learning more about? What are the things that challenge you in your work? So what kind of things would you like to learn more about? Rather than we've got this great program we're going to train you in, whether you want it or not. So I think it, you know, like most things, it boils down to relationships and communication, I think.
But it seems to me that that's actually still very rare. So you may have a command or a rubric of doing this with staff, improving the conditions of staff, taking an interest, doing an annual appraisal which makes contact with staff rather than just being a form for them to spend time filling in. But actually implementing these measures in the kind of genuine sort of way that you're meaning seems very difficult still.
Yeah, I agree. It's I worked with one organisation where to look at resilience and how it could be promoted within the organisation, and they were forward thinking enough to allow me to do a separate session with senior and middle managers about their roles in contributing to resilient outcomes for staff members. And because there's a paper by Vogelvang that comes out of the Spore study, which has some very clear messages for managers, and so looking at this together with them, helping them to think about their responsibilities towards their staff in terms of resilience, rather than just buying in a trainer or consultant to train staff to be more resilient. You know, there, which isn't to say, you know, there is value in helping professionals to notice their responses to stressful events. There is value in helping people to download apps that help them monitor their emotions and prioritize sleep. All of those things, I'm not mocking them. I might sound like I am. They are valuable, but on their own, they're not complete. And if you only invest in those kinds of interventions aimed at frontline workers, then you're actually responsibilising them for their own resilience. Whereas I strongly believe that it needs to be a system-wide approach. So senior and middle managers need to take responsibility for their part as well.
Do you think some of that's made more challenging by virtue of working for the public sector? So I suppose it seems as if it's not part of the culture or philosophy of organisations to recognise that the work itself can be quite dangerous to people's well-being, and therefore part and parcel of delivering interventions is about making sure that staff actually receive something too, in order to enable them to do that. I mean, I just started watching The House of Cards last night, and there's a scene where somebody who's the head of a charity is instructing one of her staff to make lots of people redundant, and saying, well, we're not a charity for the staff, we're a charity for when she's challenged about the lack of compassion. And it somehow, in a way, that seems to be there within our culture of the public sector, that actually it seems as though it's seen to be frivolous and a luxury to deliver a service in a way that actually protects the well-being of the staff delivering it, as well as focusing on improving the health and well-being of the people that are receiving the service.
Yeah, I really agree with you, Naomi. I think that's been my experience as well in many different public sector organisations I've worked in. I think the best managers manage both. My experience of the best managers, when I reflect on my career, I can think of two or three managers who were very good at the managerial aspects of the job, you know, getting the job done, meeting targets, throughput, making sure systems worked well, that kind of stuff, the spreadsheet stuff, I guess. But they were also really good at the human element. In the public sector, everything we achieve through relationships. Yeah, that's my belief anyway. Maybe that sounds a bit idealistic or oversimplified, but when I think about the things I think I've achieved as a professional in whatever role, it's always been through relationship and connection, whether that's building a good professional network so that we can support a person, you know, building a good network with somebody in prison, somebody in housing, somebody in the police, and me, thinking together about how we can support somebody who might be very vulnerable, or whether it's through directly building a relationship of trust and authenticity with somebody who's in prison or under probation supervision, or with their family. You know, very often a lot of the best work I feel like I've done has been with people's families. And that's, so everything I feel I've achieved, I have achieved through relationships with other people. And in order to do that, we have to feel able to put ourselves into that. The only way of, you know, we don't work in a shoelace factory where we just make widgets or toggles on the end of shoelaces. You know, we're in a very human business, so to speak. And so the biggest, it's a bit of a cliche, but the biggest resource that prisons, probation, hospitals, community services have are the workforce, because it's only through those relationships that anything happens that's worth happening. So, you know, it's back to those words of Toni Morrison. If we're going to work at the interface of pain, poverty and powerlessness and stay close enough to the action, we have to feel supported. And you know, professionals who I see who would describe themselves as having burnt out, I think for them what matters was they weren't able to stay close enough to the action because they weren't supported. And that has negative outcomes for everybody. So yeah, absolutely. But, you know, there has to be a balance. We don't go to work as therapy. You know, I work now as a psychotherapist. I used to work as a group worker, a probation officer. In neither of those was it my job to go to work for my own benefit or my own development or my own learning. That wasn't my job. But it has to be acknowledged as an important side effect of doing the work with a curious mind and an open heart. It means that you will learn and grow.
And is that any different to, you know, using heavy machinery that needs servicing once a year? Or, you know, we think nothing of the costs that would be incurred there, where we have to replace equipment. So actually, you're right, there's kind of like the running costs of when the people are the tools of the trade.
Yeah. That's so true. Can I give you this is the best metaphor I ever heard for this is from Jon Kabat-Zinn, the mindfulness teacher and practitioner. And he wrote that the best orchestra in the world. So if you imagine, I don't know, maybe the Berlin Philharmonic, that might be controversial, but yeah, they're often thought of as the best orchestra in the world. If you listen to the violin section of the Berlin Philharmonic tackling a piece of music without tuning up their instruments, it will sound like a deafening, horrible noise. Even though they are the best musicians in the world playing the most expensive instruments with the best conductor in the world. And it's the time that is taken to tune up the violins and to tune up together. So for one violin to tune up next to the violin that's next to them, next to the violin that's next to them, in community with each other. It's that investment of time that makes a difference to the whole performance. And Jon Kabat-Zinn is offering that as a metaphor for checking in with ourselves as professionals and taking care of ourselves. We need to tune up with ourselves and also in connection with our colleagues and our organisation. And I really like that metaphor, taking time to tune ourselves up.
Yeah, that is a really beautiful metaphor. And I think brings us to the end of the interview, really, Lydia. And I think you've already kind of answered this, but maybe that you might have something else to offer up as well. But when we meet with people for the podcast, we're always very interested to hear how they've maintained their own well-being over what's been many years of encounters with harsh systems that are often very difficult to work within. And you really come across as very generous spirited and compassionate in your outlook, and I wondered how you've managed to retain this positive outlook over the years. Is there anything you would add that you've not already raised within the interview?
Yeah, it's a great question.
I think if my kids are next door in the kitchen, if I went and asked them, would they think of me as compassionate and kind-hearted? They would probably have quite a different story for you. I think I'm really curious. I love learning. I love reading and going on new trainings and learning from different professions about their value, you know, their theory base. So I think always continuing to learn and grow in terms of the theories that I have at my disposal. Being curious about myself and my own narrative. I think I've had periods of my life where I've been in therapy for myself, which has been hugely important for me. The way I tell my own life story, now aged 48, is very different from how I used to tell it age 18. I have a much more integrated understanding of some of the difficult experiences I've had as an individual, and that helps me to be much more aware of my own reactions to people I'm working with, and to notice my own emotions more, and to use them in my work with people. I'm far more confident doing that than I used to be. I think also I'm really stubborn, and so I don't give up with people. However, a person might be really aggressive or angry with me or refuse to speak to me or whatever it might be. But I usually interpret that as a sign that they're struggling with something. I try not to take it personally, and I show up the next day. I show up the day after that until they're ready to speak with me about whatever it was they need to speak about. And then I think finally I'm an optimist, so I think hope is really important to me. In my own family story, there are lots of examples of people overcoming trauma and adversity, growing and healing. Healing is the word, I think. There's a lot of healing in my family story, and so I have a really passionate belief in human beings' ability to heal and grow and to keep on developing. I view it as my role to hold on to hope for people until they're ready to hold it for themselves. And for me, that's a privilege. I view it as a real, genuinely, as a being invited into someone's life at a moment of challenge, whether they're a patient in the NHS or a prisoner who's committed a very serious offence, or a family member, whoever, or somebody I'm supervising. For somebody to trust me with their story is a huge privilege, and I always carry that very respectfully, and with hope and optimism and stubbornness that I'm going to carry on showing up until they're ready to work and to heal.
Thank you so much for such an interesting but also really honest and open conversation. Really appreciated that, Lydia. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed. I'm struck by how often what you describe as stubbornness, but others have described as persistence, crops up in these conversations. So that was really inspirational. So thanks very much indeed. Lydia. Yeah,
thank you. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you both today. Thanks very much for such brilliant questions as well.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Lydia. She reminded me a bit of Rob Canton, actually, in her ability to recollect fantastic phrases and quotes from other people that she's read, in a way that I really wish I had the capacity to remember little beautiful nuggets of conversation in that way. But I suppose what I really liked about Lydia was her warmth that comes through in the conversation, and drawing on so many different pieces of knowledge and weaving them together in a way that seems quite seamless, and they just make sense together. And I think that's quite refreshing in the forensic world, certainly, where I think people sticking to one line of inquiry and one model seems to be much more the norm.
Yeah, well, you said it all there, I think. I mean, I was struck right at the beginning when she was talking about her trip on the bus from Blackbird Lees, just outside Oxford, down to the High Street in Oxford, which is lined with examination halls and colleges. And I thought that was a very powerful description. There used to be a sign just down the road from there, a road sign which said, "Changed priorities ahead." And my friends and I used to joke about the cruel reality of that. But I agree. I think she's obviously terribly bright and has this great capacity for reading, understanding, and synthesizing information, and then being able to present it in the way that's kind of suffused with warmth and conviction. So, great conversation. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, "You Have Called Me Courage," and this is available from all the usual outlets.